The Education Channel supports individual educational goals and encourages creativity for all. Visit UCTV.tv/education.
It's wonderful to be here. I'm Gloria Corral. I'm president and CEO of Parent Institute for Quality Education. It's a social justice educational equity organization. And I'm so excited to share a little bit about where I come from, my family. So we are, as so many people, an immigrant family. My parents come from Durango, a very, very small town in the state of Durango in Mexico. And they came to Tijuana, which is where I was born, seeking what so many people seek, right? A better life for themselves and their children. And I grew up being binational, bilingual, bicultural, growing up in a community in San Diego, right on the border. In fact, San Isidro is the most heavily trafficked point of entry in the world. So that just tells you the richness of the region. Education for both my parents was the way through which we could create a better future. And I will tell you that my dad's words, still to this day, I hear them. I'm fortunate enough to have my dad and my mom with me still. And my dad would always tell us, la única herencia que les voy a dejar es su educación. I may not leave you much. The only heritage or inheritance that I will leave you is the education, because that can't be taken from you. Porque nadie se las puede quitar, right? And so that kind of tells you what and how my parents viewed education. It was not only an opportunity that they could see for a better future. I think my dad and my mom both also felt that we were blessed to be in this country. And so we had a sense of responsibility and obligation to do well in school, because there were so many of our family, so many other children that didn't have access to the opportunities that my parents saw were available. You know, it's interesting as I think about my tenure at UCSD, really anchoring, now with in retrospect, obviously, really anchoring some of my early experiences and sort of this sense of responsibility for others that my dad really instilled in us, both my dad and my mom, but my dad, I think, especially because he was the one that would often ask a question when we would come home about, like, ¿qué hiciste? ¿Cómo ayudaste? Right? Like, what did you do? How did you help others? And as I think about that, obviously, with the benefit of retrospect, you know, at the time, it seemed very annoying. And like, it was often a difficult question that I avoided, because sometimes I felt like I didn't do enough, right? Like, I was studying, and I felt like getting good grades was really important. And so to have this added sort of responsibility to come back to every weekend and like answer that question from my dad, right, was, I think, was stressful at the time. And yet I would say that because of that sense of responsibility, you know, my dad and my mom always saying how we were blessed to be in this country, being able to have an education meant that at UCSD, I would say there were sort of huge, moments in my trajectory here. I think one that really stands out very early on was choosing to run for freshman senator for my college, which was third college at the time. Not knowing what that meant, but just knowing that the opportunity was there, and that, quite frankly, that the voices that I was hearing represent us as students didn't reflect my experience or the experience of the students I was in community with. As far as I know, I was the first woman of color to be senator as part of our associated student government. And, you know, I would say that that really, at a very young age, I was 17 at the time, you know, allowed me to understand sort of how power and structures really impacted in at that time, obviously, students' lives, whether it was fees, whether it was access. At that time, there was no such thing as, you know, ethnic studies. So, you know, what did that mean, and how do you have a voice? I remember having to go to the Academic Senate at UCSD. And if anyone has had that experience, imagine an 18-year-old trying to advocate in front of PhD plus level people for something that seems so validating to our experience and yet so foreign, right, in that context. And so I would say being part of the associate student body was seminal very early on in my UCSD trajectory as a formative part of why and how advocacy became action-driven and not theoretical. It's interesting to think about how words and, you know, what comes first, the feeling or the words, right? And it's an interesting question. The spark for social justice, really, I would say, was more of a feeling of understanding my privilege. Now, I think most people would look at our circumstances and question whether or not there was privilege, actually. You know, San Isidro at the time was 99% Mexican immigrants. You know, the closest, it was a food desert long before that coin was termed, or maybe it was termed, but no one was using it in my community. And so when you think about the community where I grew up, I think some would be challenged to see it as, you know, as a privilege to grow up there, both because of the poverty that's in the community and still remains, unfortunately, the low quality education that was afforded there. You know, I would say that, you know, those are structural issues that generated this idea that social justice needed to happen, right? Again, I didn't know that at the time. I didn't have the words for it. I just knew that things weren't right, right? And I say that because my dad and my mom instilled this really strong sense of right by others, this sense of community, that if you are well, but your neighbor isn't, right? If you are well, but your tia isn't, or your cousin, or the neighbor three doors down from where you are, right? That you are all in it together. And I think certainly my dad would not say that that was social justice. I think in Mexico, coming at a time when it was repressed, quite frankly, my dad would say, stay away from doing any protesting. In fact, he often did not know that I did it, in case he's watching this. Student protests were completely something that were foreign to him because of the violence that happened in Mexico during those times of social unrest, right? And so it's interesting to think about what was the spark. I think the spark was the example that my parents gave every day through their actions, that we are part of a community, that there are things that are right and wrong, that are privileged to be in an environment where there are opportunities, comes with the responsibility of being communal in our thinking and the responsibility of not being selfish. How was my undergraduate experience shaped? It was really by, I think, some of the structural racism that exists in higher education, especially when I was here, which was in the late 80s, early 90s, because there were classes that you took if you looked like me, and there was classes you didn't take if you looked like me, right? And so I often think about that, like, could I have done something else, like a doctor? Possibly, you know, I don't know, maybe not, but I would never know because that just wasn't a career option at the time, right? I think the other really interesting institutional experience that was interesting that shaped my work was I ended up deciding to pursue and do an honors thesis out of my poli-sci degree. And it was so interesting because I decided to really focus on women activism, political activism in Tijuana. And if you know anything about Mexican politics back then, is that women were not seen and certainly were not heard, right? The only role for women back then in politics was to be somebody's wife, right? And then you made sure you looked pretty and that you had makeup on and that, you know, you fit that role as a politician's wife. It was changing at the time. And I was really interested by this question. And it was very interesting because I go to my thesis advisor and I say, look, I'm really interested in exploring this question. And my thesis advisor saying, well, this is a fad. It's too political. Like, this doesn't warrant the kind of intellectual rigor that an honors thesis should demonstrate, right? And of course, that didn't make sense to me. It was an emerging area of women being empowered. And so, you know, I think in that way, it kind of resembles it because the otherness or like, we've never done this. Why are we doing it? Which is in stark contrast to the science, right? The hard sciences here at UCSD, we pride ourselves in being the innovators and doing things that have never been done before, right? Thankfully, I pursued it anyway, kind of in the DL, right? So I had to kind of figure out my own resources and, like, you know, asking Peter Smith, who was not my thesis advisor, for advice and kind of like risking, I would say, being approved, but knowing that it was the right thing because this is what I wanted to learn. So all of that, I think, I lived through. I am happy to say that, you know, the happy conclusion of my honors thesis is that, you know, it is one of the first kind of written documents that began to document the women's movement in Tijuana, for sure, and I think more collectively in Mexico. I didn't know that something like a master's degree existed, and I certainly didn't know what public policy was. I will tell you that the way that I ended up at UC Berkeley was because a very dear friend of mine from high school saw, back in the day, there were posters, and then you had to like rip the bottom of it and make a phone call. So she ripped it out. There was this opportunity to go to Berkeley for the summer to learn about public policy. So she found out about it. She thought it would be so great. And then she told me, she's like, Gloria, how about you going to Berkeley for the summer with me? And that was because she and I knew each other from high school. We were very close friends. And because her parents were very strict, as were mine at the time. And they knew each other. So I think we both knew that, like, saying, you know, my friend is going meant, like, there's a greater probability of us being allowed to go, right? As young Latinas from a very traditional home environment. And because I went to this program over the summer, I learned about what public policy was. Again, like, I just didn't have the language. I realized that those were the questions that I had about, like, why does the education system produce only one, you know, person going to higher ed? I don't know, right? Like, so these questions about structural education systems came up. And so I was fortunate enough to be selected for that program. And again, going and talking to Peter Smith about it, you know, he was very thoughtful in his counsel because he had really encouraged me to think about getting a PhD in political science. And so, you know, when we talked about this opportunity about pursuing a public policy degree, what he said to me to think about was, you know, what questions really made me excited, right? What was it that I really wanted to learn about? And at the time I said, well, I really want to do binational studies because eventually I would love to work for the UN, you know, become a diplomat, something like that. And I want to study here at UCSD. And he very, I think, thoughtfully, and I credit him really to really expand my horizons, because what he said was, well, I wouldn't want you to stay at UCSD to get your PhD. you really need to go to Texas, Florida, New York. It'll enrich your perspective. And so in some ways, by default, by him sharing that I wouldn't be able, or that he didn't think staying at UCSD was really the best option for me in my professional growth, it was like, well, if I can't get a PhD at UCSD doing political science, why not a master's degree in public policy at UC Berkeley, right? And so that's what I did. And I credit him both because he believed that a PhD was a possibility for me, and also for, kind of lifting the veil a little bit, making my world, quite frankly, a little bigger. And that's what how I ended up getting a master's in public policy. It was a really difficult time because the other option was to go to Boston and pursue a master's in diplomacy. And, what that would mean for me in my life and the career trajectory, right? And so I ended up, after a lot of sleepless nights and conversations and reflections, deciding that I really wanted to make an impact at home, in this country, in my neighborhood, in California. And because of that, that really, really reflected sort of my intellectual curiosity. I decided to pursue the master's in public policy with a particular focus in education and urban development, sort of how does education get impacted by decisions about where to place trolley stops, grocery stores or not, right? Which was the case in San Ysidro, which is where I grew up. And how does that impact a child's and a family's ability to access high quality educational opportunities, right? And so that's what I ended up studying and loving it. So I get this master's degree in public policy. Most people don't know what that is. I kind of didn't either, but I was very fortunate to then have an opportunity right out of grad school to go to DC and be part of what the time was called Presidential Management Internship Program, which was really designed to select kind of the top talent across the country for public service, to really kind of infuse the federal government with young, talented policy thinkers, very cheap, I would say. I remember, I think my salary was like $30,000, which was really challenging. But it really exposed me, obviously, to incredible opportunities. Through that program, I worked at the U.S. Department of Education doing policy work at the Office of Elementary and Secondary Education. I worked in Congress, so I was very fortunate to work on the House side of the Congress doing appropriations. So really thinking about how money and decision making impacts policy. And then had the opportunity to work in the late Senator Kennedy's education staff, thinking about higher ed reauthorization. And so really during my almost 4 years there, got a sense of what the big policy, capital P, really meant in terms of education policy across the country, right? Because we were thinking about it nationally and the implications that that had kind of closer to home. So I did that very early on in my career and then came back to California and did what most people think about kind of traditional policy, was part of a think tank, did a lot of thinking and writing about policy choices that governors could make, that district leaders could make, and spent half of my career really thinking about that, always with an emphasis on families and communities that did not speak English as a home language, really thinking about opportunities for highly distressed communities because of underinvestment. And so that was always sort of what I found was important in the policy conversations, because that decisions would impact that particular segment of the population. So I did that for quite a bit and then kind of transitioned very intentionally and purposefully to the 0-5 space. And for many that don't know, in California, about 75% of children under the age of 5 are Black and brown, And that statistic is what really inspired me to think, how do I impact that pipeline of greatness and diversity in the state? And so I spent about almost 15 years in the 0-5 space at First 5 San Francisco and then First 5 San Diego, and really thinking about how do families and communities nurture and support the brilliance of young children? Because the education system isn't designed to educate them. Because, you know, that's how it was set up. And so it does produce, I think, very efficiently the outcomes it was set up to do. Educate some and not educate others. And so I really focused on how do families and communities think about nurturing our youngest children, with the idea then, you know, we would start at prenatal work with families and really support their transition to educational opportunities. And so that's what I was doing. I was at the County of San Diego Office of Health and Human Services, really thinking about bringing families and children more holistically to the work of the entire county. And one of my closest friends sent me an email with the job description of the current role and saying, call me. I thought it was because she was going to apply. She lives in DC, and I was so excited to have her come join us in California. We need bright minds, phenomenal women of color to keep building our ranks. And it turns out that she wanted me to call her because she wanted to tell me that this job was my next job. I wasn't looking for a job. I didn't think I could do a job like this. And what was she saying? But because she is a very dear friend of mine and, you know, whose counsel I take and whose respect I have gained and I cherish, she said, you need to apply for it. So I did. Long story short, I ended up being offered the position. I then proceeded to apparently very eloquently make a case for not hiring me because I wasn't the right candidate. And the hiring committee saying, you know, this is the first time someone has made a really strong argument to take back the offer. But in fact, what you've done is really demonstrated your commitment to the social justice and educational equity of the organization and the mission. So you are, in fact, the right person. And so 5 years later, I've been president and CEO of an incredible social justice and educational equity organization that I'm honored to lead. BICA is about dialogue. BICA is about empowering families and communities. BICA is about lifting up family voice because there is a voice, and helping families understand the education system that might be foreign to them because they are not in this country, or that has failed them because they have been in this country and the education system failed them. And so our founders really understood that it's through dialogue with families that families see each other, hear each other, and understand and begin to build community to change the opportunity trajectory and the education trajectory for their children. So what began as a dialogue with three parents at Sherman Elementary, by the fifth convening, there were 120 parents speaking five languages and all sharing the same aspiration for their children, an opportunity for their children to have a better future, and their commitment to helping that become a reality, but not knowing how to do that effectively, right? And so BICA came out of those dialogues. We've been in operation now 36 years. We're very proud of the impact that we've had. We very intentionally seek out communities that are farthest away from educational opportunities as measured by high dropout rates from high school, low performance on math and reading scores, high concentration of low-income families, high concentrations of immigrant and English learners. So this is where we see our mission as a social justice educational equity organization coming to life, being active in those communities. And that's what we do. We've served over almost 800,000 families during our 36-year trajectory, in communities with 16 different languages being served. And every year in California, we serve about 25,000 families across the state in our evidence-based model, one that really looks at meeting families where they are, validating their experience, is being replicated in 14 states across the country. You know you're getting old when you are asked to think about, some words of wisdom, right? As someone who understands that wisdom comes in different ways and at different, in all ways, I would say, both from our history, from our lived experiences. I would very humbly think that my life and who I am today are a direct reflection of the choices I've made, of the history of my ancestors, of my parents' dreams and aspirations, of my failures, and the opportunities and the blessings that I've had. And so as I think about where I am today and think about the amazing talent and wonderful new generation of students coming in that might be 17, 18, 20-year-olds, right, our transfer students, I think about three really important things that have guided me in my life. One is kindness and the ability to really see others and their journey and their lived experiences as a time of reflection, of not judging, of not assuming, but really thinking about kindness and generosity of spirit, I think, as something that needs to be very intentionally paid attention to. You know, when there's so many messages about you and like which side is your best side, like how many selfies did you take today? It's so focused on the individual that I think kindness and generosity of spirit is something that you need to cultivate and be intentional about cultivating, making it a practice, because everything else tells you to only think about you what others think about that picture of you, which may not even be you, quite frankly. So kindness and generosity. I think the other really important perspective that has helped me is to think about and value the multiplicity of identities. And I say that because you are who you are today at 18 will be someone different when you're 19 and 25. And the through line in all of that is a choice you make, for example, about how you nurture your identity. Not, is it one identity? Is it multiple identities? So I would say that as much as I joke about having 17 different hats, I don't think I would give up any of them. In fact, I know I wouldn't, because there have been times where that was a choice. I could have chosen not to be a mom, and that could have been an identity that I could have chosen. And I very thoughtfully decided that that was an identity I wanted. And I was, you know, blessed enough to be able to do that. So I would say, you know, thinking about your identity, if you happen to be bilingual or multilingual, understanding that is your superpower and recognizing that it's going to take courage, it's going to take time for you to keep it. That means traveling. That might mean, and that doesn't mean getting in a plane and going crossing a country. It means reading a book. I have to tell you, I had to read because I didn't have money to travel. So I would pick up books. I would talk to people that spoke a different language in a different culture and ask them to tell me their story, to bless me with their stories, right? So I think this sense of identity is really something that I think a lot about, right? And being curious about others and their lived experiences to help me better understand my own sense of belonging. I would say the third, which is really something that I've tried to live by, is to find joy and laughter and humor. I was, you know, just talking to my son about something that happened, and he, you know, he's 10, and every interaction feels like it's the only time anything's going to happen because you're 10, right? But I think, you know, humor can be, I think, in finding joy is something that I have found to be a really important way for me to make way in the world. There can be a lot of pain, and there is a lot of pain when you're the first, when you're the only, when you're excluded, when you feel alone. And, you know, I think humor is one of those ways, and finding joy in the smallness and in the greatness of your life and the life of others is so important. But I do think that humor and kindness and generosity of spirit are all part and parcel of what defines us, and those are choices that we can make in every situation. Sometimes those might be easier choices than others, but I invite you to really think about this sense of identity that you're creating every day.